but I haven't decided yet what I am or who I am. Charles Manson. March 1970. On March 3rd, accompanied by attorney Gary Fleischman and some dozen LAPD and LASO officers, I took Linda Kasabian out of Sybil Brand. For Linda, it was a trip back in time to an almost unbelievable night nearly 7 months ago. Our first stop was 10,050 Cielo Drive. In late June of 1969, Bob Kasabian had called Linda at her mother's home in New Hampshire, suggesting a reconciliation. Kasabian was living in a trailer in Topanga Canyon with a friend, Charles Melton. Melton, who had recently inherited $20,000 and had already given away more than half, planned to drive to the tip of South America, buy a boat, and sail around the world. He'd invited Linda and Bob, as well as another couple, to come along. Linda, together with her daughter Tanya, flew to Los Angeles, but the reconciliation was unsuccessful. On July 4, 1969, Catherine Scher, a.k.a. Gypsy, visited Melton, whom she had met through Paul Watkins. Gypsy told Linda about this beautiful man named Charlie, the family, and how life at Spawn was all love, beauty, and peace. To Linda, it was as if the answer to an unspoken prayer. My interviews with Linda Kasabian were not taped. Exact quotations are from either my interview notes, her trial testimony, or her narrative letters to me. That same day, Linda and Tanya moved to Spawn. Though she didn't meet Manson that day, she did meet most of the other members of the family, and they talked of little else. It was obvious to her that they worshipped him. That night, Tex took her into a small room and told her far-out things. Nothing was wrong, all was right. Things I couldn't comprehend. Then, he made love to me, and a strange experience took place. It was like being possessed. When it was over, Linda's fingers were clenched so tightly they hurt. Gypsy later told her that what she had experienced was the death of the ego. After making love, Linda and Tex talked, Linda mentioning Melton's inheritance. Tex told her that she should steal the money. According to Linda, she told him she couldn't do that. Melton was a friend, a brother. Tex told her that she could do no wrong and that everything should be shared. The next day, Linda went back to the trailer and stole $5,000, which she gave to either Leslie or Tex. She had already turned over all her possessions to the family, the girls having told her, "What's yours is ours, and what's ours is yours." Linda met Charles Manson for the first time that night. After all she had heard about him, she felt as if she were on trial. He asked why she had come to the ranch. She replied that her husband had rejected her. Manson reached out and felt her legs. He seemed pleased with them, Linda recalled. Then he told her she could stay. Before making love to her, he told her that she had a father hang-up. Linda was startled by his perception because she disliked her stepfather. She felt that Manson could see inside her. Linda Kasabian became a part of the family. Went on garbage runs, had sex with the men, creepy crawled the house, and listened as Manson lectured about the Beatles, Helter Skelter, and the bottomless pit. Charlie told her that the black man was together, but the white man was not. However, he knew a way to unite the white man, he said. It was the only way. But he didn't tell her what it was. Nor did she ask. From the first time they met, Manson had stressed, never ask why. When something he said or did puzzled her, she was reminded of this. Also of another of his favorite axioms, no sense makes sense. The whole family, Linda said, was paranoid of Blackie. On weekends, George Spawn did a brisk business renting horses. Occasionally, among the riders, there would be blacks. Manson maintained they were panthers, spying on the family. He always hid the young girls when they were around. At night, everyone was required to wear dark clothing so as to be less conspicuous, and eventually Manson posted armed guards who roamed the ranch until dawn. Gradually, Linda became convinced that Charles Manson was Jesus Christ. He never told her this directly, but one day he asked her, "Don't you know who I am?" She replied, "No. Am I supposed to know something?" He didn't answer, just smiled and playfully twirled her around. Yet she had doubts. The mothers were not allowed to care for their own children. They separated her and Tanya, Linda explained, because they wanted to kill the ego that I put in her, and at first I agreed to it. I thought that it was a good idea that she should become her own person. Also, several times she saw Manson strike Diane Lake. Linda had been in many communes, from the American Psychedelic Circus in Boston to Sons of the Earth Mother near Taos, but she'd never seen anything like this, and forgetting Charlie's commandment, she did ask Gypsy why. Gypsy told her that Diane really wanted to be beaten, and Charlie was only obliging her. Overriding all doubts was one fact. She had fallen in love with Charles Manson. Linda had been at Spawn Ranch a little over a month when, on the afternoon of Friday, August 8, 1969, Manson told the family, "Now is the time for Helter Skelter." Had Linda stopped there, supplying that single piece of testimony and nothing else, she would have been a valuable witness. But Linda had a great deal more to tell. That Friday evening, about an hour after dinner, seven or eight members of the family were standing on the boardwalk in front of the saloon when Manson came out and, calling Tex, Sadie, Katie, and Linda aside, told each to get a change of clothing and a knife. He also told Linda to get her driver's license. Linda, I later learned, was the only family member with a valid license, excepting Mary Brunner, who had been arrested that afternoon. This was, I concluded, probably one of the reasons why Manson had picked Linda to accompany the others, each of whom, unlike her, had been with him a year or more. Linda couldn't find her own knife. Sadie had it, but she obtained one from Larry Jones. The handle was broken and had been replaced with tape. Brenda found Linda's license and gave it to her just about the time Manson told Linda, "Go with Tex, and do whatever Tex tells you to do." According to Linda, in addition to Tex, Katie, and herself, Brenda McCann and Larry Jones were present when Manson gave this order. Brenda remained hardcore and refused to cooperate with law enforcement. Larry Jones, true name Lawrence Bailey, was a scrawny little ranch hand who was always trying to ingratiate himself with the family. However, Jones had what Manson considered negroid features, and according to Linda, Charlie was always putting him down, referring to him as the drippings from a white man's dick. Since Jones had been present when Manson instructed the Tate killers, he could be a very important witness, providing independent corroboration of Linda Kasabian's testimony, and I asked LAPD to bring him in. They were unable to find him. I then gave the assignment to the DA's Bureau of Investigation, who located Jones, but he wouldn't give us the time of day. Linda said that after Manson instructed her to go with Tex, the group piled into ranch hand Johnny Swartz's old Ford. I asked Linda what each was wearing. She wasn't absolutely sure, but she thought Sadie had on a dark blue T-shirt and dungarees, that Katie's attire was similar, and that Tex was wearing a black velour turtleneck and dark dungarees. When shown the clothing the TV crew had found, Linda identified six of the seven items, failing to recall only the white T-shirt. The logical assumption was that she hadn't seen it because it had been worn under one of the other shirts. "What about footwear?" I asked. The girls, she believed, were all barefoot. She thought, but couldn't be sure, that Tex had on cowboy boots. A number of bloody footprints had been found at the Tate murder scene. After eliminating those belonging to LAPD personnel, two remained unidentified, a boot heel print and the print of a bare foot, thus supporting Linda's recollections. Again, as with Susan Atkins, I badly needed independent corroboration of Linda's testimony. I then asked Linda the same question I'd asked Susan. Had any of them been on drugs that night? and received the same reply, "No." As Tex started to drive off, Manson said, "Hold it or wait." He then leaned in the window on the passenger side and said, "Leave a sign. You girls know what to write. Something witchy." Tex handed Linda 3 knives and a gun, telling her to wrap them in a rag and put them on the floor. If stopped by the police, Tex said, she was to throw them out. Linda positively identified the .22-caliber Longhorn revolver. Only at this time, she said, the grip had been intact and the barrel unbent. According to Linda, Tex did not tell them their destination or what they were going to do. However, she presumed they were going on another creepy crawly mission. Tex did say that he had been to the house and knew the layout. As we drove up Cielo Drive in the sheriff's van, Linda showed me where Tex had turned, in front of the gate at 10,050, then parked next to the telephone pole. He had then taken a pair of large red-handled wire cutters from the back seat and shinnied up the pole. From where she was sitting, Linda couldn't see Tex cutting the wires, but she saw and heard the wires fall. When shown the wire cutters found at Barker Ranch, Linda said they looked like the pair used that night. Since the wire cutters had been found in Manson's personal dune buggy, her identification linked them not just to the family, but to Manson himself. I was especially pleased at this evidence, unaware that link would soon be severed, literally. When Tex returned to the car, they drove to a spot near the bottom of the hill and parked. The four then took the weapons and extra clothing and stealthily walked back up to the gate. Tex also had some white rope which was draped over his shoulder. As Linda and I got out of the sheriff's van and approached the gate at 10,050 Cielo Drive, two large dogs belonging to Rudy Altabelli began barking furiously at us. Linda suddenly began sobbing. "What are you crying about, Linda?" I asked. Pointing to the dogs, she said, "Why couldn't they have been here that night?" Linda pointed to the spot to the right of the gate where they had climbed the embankment and scaled the fence. As they were descending the other side, a pair of headlights suddenly appeared in the driveway. "Lay down and be quiet," Tex ordered. He then jumped up and ran to the automobile, which had stopped near the gate control mechanism. Linda heard a man's voice saying, "Please, don't hurt me. I won't say anything." She then saw Tex put the gun in the open window on the driver's side and heard 4 shots. She also saw the man slump over in the seat. Something here puzzled me, and still does. In addition to the gunshot wounds, Stephen Parent had a defensive stab wound that ran from the palm across the wrist of his left hand. It severed the tendons as well as the band of his wristwatch. Obviously, Parent had raised his left hand, the hand closest to the open window, in an effort to protect himself, the force of the blow being sufficient to hurl his watch into the back seat. It therefore appeared that Tex must have approached the car with a knife in one hand, a gun in the other, and that he first slashed at Parent, then shot him. Yet neither Susan nor Linda saw Tex with a knife at this point, nor did either recall the stabbing. Linda saw Tex reach in the car and turn off the lights and ignition. He then pushed the car some distance up the driveway, telling the others to follow him. "The shooting put her in a state of shock," Linda said. "My mind went blank. I was aware of my body, walking toward the house." As we went up the driveway, I asked Linda which lights had been on that night. She pointed to the bug light on the side of the garage, also the Christmas tree lights along the fence. Little details, yet important if the defense contended Linda was fabricating her story from what she had read in the papers, since neither these nor numerous other details I collected had appeared in the press. As we approached the residence, I noticed that Linda was shivering and her arms were covered with goosebumps. Though it wasn't cold that day, Linda was now 9 months pregnant, and I slipped off my coat and put it over her shoulders. The shivering continued, however, all the time we were on the premises, and often, in pointing out something, she would begin crying. There was no question in my mind that the tears were real and that she was deeply affected by what had happened in this place. I couldn't help contrasting Linda with Susan. When they reached the house, Linda said, Tex sent her around the back to look for an unlocked window or door. She reported that everything was locked, though she hadn't actually checked. This explained why they ignored the open nursery window. Tex then slit a screen on one of the front windows with a knife. Though the actual screen had since been replaced, Linda pointed to the correct window. She also said the slash was horizontal as it had been. Tex then told her to go back and wait by the car in the driveway. Linda did as she was told. Perhaps a minute or two later, Katie came back and asked Linda for her knife. This was the knife with the taped handle, and told her, listen for sounds. A few minutes later, Linda heard horrifying sounds coming from the house. A man moaned, no, 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 then screamed very loudly. The scream, which seemed continuous, was punctuated with other voices, male and female, begging and pleading for their lives. Wanting to stop what was happening, Linda said, I started running toward the house. As she reached the walk, there was a man, a tall man, just coming out of the door, staggering, and he had blood all over his face, and he was standing by a post, and we looked into each other's eyes for a minute. I don't know however long, and I said, oh God, I'm so sorry. And then he just fell into the bushes. And then Sadie came running out of the house, and I said, Sadie, please make it stop. People are coming. Which wasn't true, but I wanted to make it stop. And she said, it's too late. Complaining that she had lost her knife, Susan ran back into the house. Linda remained outside. Susan had earlier told me and the grand jury that Linda had never entered the residence. Turning, Linda saw a dark-haired woman in a white gown running across the lawn. Katie was pursuing her, an upraised knife in her hand. Somehow the tall man managed to stagger from the bushes next to the porch onto the lawn, where he had again fallen. Linda saw Tex hit him over the head with something. It could have been a gun, but she wasn't sure, then stab him repeatedly in the back as he lay on the ground. Shown a number of photographs, Linda identified the tall man as Wojtek Frankowski, the dark-haired woman as Abigail Folger. Examining the autopsy report on Frankowski, I found that 5 of his 51 stab wounds were to the back. Linda turned and ran down the driveway. For what seemed like maybe 5 minutes, she hid in the bushes near the gate, then climbed the fence again and ran down Cielo to where they had parked the Ford. Question. Why didn't you run to one of the houses and call the police? I asked Linda. Answer. My first thought was get help. Then my little girl entered my mind. She was back at the ranch with Charlie. I didn't know where I was or how to get out of there. She got in the car and had started the engine when all of a sudden they were there. They were covered with blood. They looked like zombies. Tex yelled at me to turn off the car and get over. He had a terrible look in his eyes. Linda slid over to the passenger side. Then he started in on Sadie and yelled at her for losing her knife. Tex had put the .22 revolver on the seat between them. Linda noticed that the grip was broken, and Tex told her it had smashed when he hit the man over the head. Sadie and Katie complained that their heads hurt because the people had pulled their hair while they were fighting with them. Sadie also said the big man had hit her over the head and that the girl, it was unclear whether she meant Sharon or Abigail, had cried for her mother. Katie also complained that her hand hurt, explaining that when she stabbed, she kept hitting bones, and since the knife didn't have a regular handle, it bruised her hand. Question. How did you feel, Linda? Answer. In a state of shock. Question. What about the others? How did they act? Answer. As if it was all a game. Tex, Sadie, and Katie changed their clothing while the car was in motion, Linda holding the wheel for Tex. Linda herself didn't change since there was no blood on her. Tex told them he wanted to find a place to hose the blood off, and he turned off Benedict Canyon onto a short street not too far from the Tate residence. Linda's account of the hosing incident paralleled Susan Atkins and Rudolph Weber's. Weber's house was located 1.8 miles from the Tate premises. From there, Tex turned onto Benedict Canyon again and drove along through a dark, hilly country area. He stopped the car on a dirt shoulder off the road, and Tex, Sadie, and Katie gave Linda their bloody clothing, which, on Tex's instructions, she rolled up in one bundle and threw down the slope. Since it was dark, she couldn't see where it landed. After driving off, Tex told Linda to wipe the knives clean of fingerprints, then throw them out the window. She did, the first knife hitting a bush at the side of the road, the second, which she tossed out a few seconds later, striking the curb and bouncing back into the road. Looking back, she saw it lying there. Linda believed she threw the gun out a few minutes later, but she wasn't sure. It was possible that Tex did it. After driving for a time, they stopped at a gas station. Linda was unable to recall the street, where Katie and Sadie took turns going into the restroom to wash the rest of the blood off their bodies. Then they drove back to Spawn Ranch. Linda did not have a watch, but guessed it must have been about 2 a.m. Charles Manson was standing on the boardwalk in the same spot where he had been when they drove off. Sadie said she saw some blood on the outside of the car, and Manson had the girls get rags and sponges and wash the car inside and out. He then told them to go to the bunkhouse. Brenda and Clem were already there. Manson asked Tex how it had gone. Tex told him that there was a lot of panic, that it was real messy, and that there were bodies lying all over the place, but that everyone was dead. Manson asked the four, "Do you have any remorse?" All shook their heads and said no. Linda did feel remorse, she told me, but she didn't admit it to Charlie because I was afraid for my life. I could see in his eyes he knew how I felt, and it was against his way. Manson told them, "Go to bed and say nothing to the others." Linda slept most of the day. It was almost sundown when Sadie told her to go into the trailer, that the TV news was coming on. Although Linda could not recall seeing Tex, she remembered Sadie, Katie, Barbara Hoyt, and Clem being there. It was the big news. For the first time, Linda heard the names of the victims. She also learned that one, Sharon Tate, had been pregnant. Only a few days earlier, Linda had learned that she herself was pregnant. "As we were watching the news," Linda said, "in my head I kept saying, why would they do such a thing?" After Linda and I left the Tate residence, I asked her to show us the route they had taken. She found the dirt shoulder where they had pulled off to dispose of the clothing, but was unable to find the street where Tex had turned off Benedict Canyon, so I had the sheriff's deputy who was driving take us directly to Portola. Once on the street, Linda immediately identified 9870, pointing to the hose in front. Number 9870 was Rudolph Weber's house. She also pointed to the spot where they had parked the car. It was the same spot Weber had indicated. Neither his address nor even the fact that he had been located had appeared in the press. We were back on Benedict looking for the area where Linda had thrown out the knives when one of the deputies said, "We've got company." Looking out the window, we saw we were being followed by a Channel 2 TV unit. Its presence in the area may have been a coincidence, but I doubted it. More likely, someone at the jail or in the courts had alerted the press that we were taking Linda out. At this time, only a few people knew that Linda Kasabian would be a witness for the prosecution. I'd hoped to keep this secret as long as possible. I'd also hoped to take Linda to the LaBianca residence and several other sites, but now that would have to wait. Telling Linda to turn her head away so she wouldn't be recognized, I asked the driver to hightail it back to Sybil Brand. Once on the freeway, we tried to outrun the TV unit, but without success. They filmed us all the way. It was like a Max Sennett comedy, only with the press in pursuit of the fuzz. After Linda was back in jail, I asked Sergeant McGann to get some cadets from the police academy or a troop of Boy Scouts and conduct a search for the knives. From Linda's testimony, we knew that they had probably been thrown out of the car somewhere between the clothing site and the hill where young Stephen Weiss had found the gun, an area of less than 2 miles. We also knew that since Linda had looked back and seen one of the knives lying in the road, there must have been some illumination nearby, which could be another clue. The following day, March 4th, Gypsy made another visit to Fleischman's office. She told him, in the presence of his law partner Ronald Goldman, if Linda testifies, 30 people are going to do something about it. I'd already checked out the security at Sybil Brand. Until her baby was born, Linda was being kept in an isolation cell off the infirmary. She had no contact with the other inmates. Deputies brought her meals. After the baby was born, however, she would be reassigned to one of the open dormitories where she might be threatened, even killed by Sadie, Katie, or Leslie. I made a note to talk to Captain Carpenter to see if other arrangements could be made. Attorney Richard Caballero had been able to postpone the inevitable, but he couldn't prevent it. The meeting between Susan Atkins and Charles Manson took place in the Los Angeles County Jail on March 5th. Caballero, who was present, would later testify. One of the first things they wanted to know was whether either one had gotten to see Linda Kasabian yet. Neither having done so, it was decided both should keep trying. Manson asked Susan, "Are you afraid of the gas chamber?" Susan grinned and replied that she wasn't. With that, Caballero must have realized that he had lost her. Susan and Charlie talked for an hour or so more, but Caballero hadn't the foggiest idea of what they said. At some point in the conversation, they began to talk in sort of a double talk or pig Latin, and when they reached that point, they lost me. However, the looks they exchanged said it all. It was like a joyous homecoming. Sadie Mae Glutz had returned to the irresistible Charles Manson. She fired Caballero the next day. On March 6th, Manson appeared in court and argued a number of novel motions. One asked that the deputy district attorneys in charge of the trial be incarcerated for a period of time under the same circumstances that I have been subject to. Another requested that he be free to travel to any place I should deem fit in preparing my defense. There were more, and Judge Keene declared himself appalled at Manson's outlandish requests. Keene then said he had reviewed the entire file on the case, from his nonsensical motions to his numerous violations of the gag order. He had also discussed Manson's conduct with Judges Lucas and Dell, before whom Manson had also appeared, concluding that it had become abundantly clear to me that you are incapable of acting as your own attorney. Infuriated, Manson shouted, "It's not me that's on trial here as much as this court is on trial." He also told the judge, "Go wash your hands. They're dirty." The court, "Mr. Manson, your status at this time of acting as your own attorney is now vacated." Against Manson's strong objections, Keene appointed Charles Hollopeter, a former president of the Los Angeles Criminal Courts Bar, as Manson's attorney of record. "You can kill me," Manson said, "but you can't give me an attorney. I won't take one." Keene told Manson that if he found an attorney of his own choosing, he would consider a motion to substitute him for Hollopeter. I knew Hollopeter by reputation. Since he'd never been Charlie's bootlicker, I guessed he'd last about a month. I was too generous. Toward the end of the proceedings, Manson shouted, "There is no God in this courtroom." As if on cue, a number of family members jumped up and yelled at Keene, "You are a mockery of justice. You are a joke." The judge found three of them, Gypsy, Sandy, and Mark Ross, in contempt, and sentenced each to 5 days in the county jail. When Sandy was searched prior to being booked, among the items found in her purse was a buck knife. After this, the sheriff's deputies, who were in charge of maintaining security in the Los Angeles criminal courts, began searching all spectators before they entered the courtroom. On March 7th, Linda Kasabian was taken to the hospital. 2 days later, she gave birth to a boy, whom she named Angel. On the 13th, she was returned to the jail without the child, Linda's mother having taken him back to New Hampshire. In the interim, I had talked to Captain Carpenter, and he had agreed to let Linda remain in her former cell just off the infirmary. I checked it out myself. It was a small room, its furnishings consisting of a bed, toilet bowl, wash basin, and a small desk and chair. It was clean, but bleak. Far more important, it was safe. Every few days, I called McGann. No, he hadn't got around to looking for the knives yet.
On March 11th, Susan Atkins, after formally requesting that Richard Caballero be relieved as her attorney, asked for Day Shin in Caballero's place.
Inasmuch as Shin, one of the first attorneys to call on Manson after he was brought down from Independence, had represented Manson on several matters and had visited him more than 40 times, Judge Keene felt there might be a possible conflict of interest involved. Shin denied this. Keene then warned Susan of the possible dangers of being represented by an attorney who had been so closely involved with one of her co-defendants. Susan said she didn't care. She wanted Shin. Keene granted the substitution. I hadn't come up against Shin before. He was about 40, Korean-born. According to the press, his main practice, before allying himself with the Manson defense, had been obtaining Mexican domestics for Southern California families. On leaving the courtroom, Shin told waiting reporters that Susan Atkins definitely will deny everything she told the grand jury. On March 15th, we took Linda Kasabian out again. Only this time we used not a conspicuous sheriff's van, but unmarked police cars. I wanted Linda to trace the route the killers had taken the night the LaBiancas were killed. After dinner that night, Saturday, August 9th, 1969, Linda and several other family members were standing outside the kitchen at Spawn. Manson called Linda, Katie, and Leslie aside and told them to get a change of clothing and meet him in the bunkhouse. This time he mentioned nothing to Linda about knives, but he did tell her again to get her driver's license. I just looked at him and, you know, just sort of pleaded with my eyes, please don't make me go. Because, Linda said, I just knew we were going out again, and I knew it would be the same thing. But I was afraid to say anything. Last night was too messy, Manson told the group when they assembled in the bunkhouse. This time I'm going to show you how to do it. Tex complained that the weapons they had used the previous night weren't effective enough. Linda saw two swords in the bunkhouse, one of which was the straight Satan's sword. She did not see anyone pick them up, but later she noticed the Satan's sword and two smaller knives under the front seat of the car. In questioning DiCarlo, I'd learned that one night about this time, he'd noticed that the sword had been taken out. Again, the group piled into Swartz's Ford. This time Manson himself slipped into the driver's seat, with Linda next to him, Clem on the passenger side, Tex, Sadie, Katie, and Leslie crowded in back. All wore dark clothing, Linda said, except for Clem, who had on an olive drab field jacket. As he often did, Manson wore a leather thong around his neck, the two ends extending down to his breastbone, where they were looped together. I asked Linda if anyone else was wearing such a thong. She said no. Before they left, Manson asked Bruce Davis for some money. Just as DiCarlo took care of the family guns, Davis acted as comptroller for the group, taking care of the stolen credit cards, fake ID, and so forth. As they drove off, Manson told them that tonight they would divide into two groups. Each would take a separate house. He said he'd drop off one group, then take the second group with him. When they stopped to buy gas, using cash, not a credit card, Manson told Linda to take over the driving. Questioning Linda, I established that Manson, and Manson alone, gave all the instructions as to where they were to go and what they were to do. At no time, she said, did Tex Watson instruct anyone to do anything. Charlie was in complete command. Following Manson's directions, Linda took the freeway to Pasadena. Once off it, he gave her so many directions she was unsure where they were. Eventually, he told her to stop in front of a house, which Linda described as a modern, one-story, middle-class-type home. This was the place where, as described by Susan Atkins, Manson got out, had them drive around the block, then got back in, telling them that, having looked in the window and seen photographs of children, he didn't want to do that particular house, though he added, in the future it might be necessary to kill children also. Linda's account was essentially the same as Susan's. After riding around Pasadena for some time, Manson again took over the driving. Linda, I remember we started driving up a hill with lots of houses, nice houses, rich houses, and trees. We got to the top of the hill and turned around and stopped in front of a certain house. Linda couldn't remember if it was one story or two, only that it was big. Manson, however, said the houses were too close together here, so they drove off. Shortly after this, Manson spotted a church. Pulling into the parking lot next to it, he again got out. Linda believed, but wasn't absolutely sure, that he told them he was going to get the minister or priest. However, he returned a few minutes later, saying the church door was locked. Susan Atkins had neglected to mention the church in her account. I learned of it for the first time from Linda Kasabian. Manson again told Linda to drive, but the route he gave her was so confusing that she soon became lost. Later, driving up Sunset from the ocean, there occurred another incident which Susan Atkins had neglected to mention. Observing a white sports car ahead of him, Manson told Linda, "At the next red light, pull up beside it. I'm going to kill the driver." Linda pulled up next to the car, but just as Manson jumped out, the light changed to green, and the sports car zoomed away. Another potential victim, unaware to this day how close to death he had come. Thus far, their wanderings appeared totally at random, Manson seemingly having no particular victims in mind. As I'd later argue to the jury, up to this time no one in the vast, sprawling metropolis of 7 million people, whether in a home, a church, or even a car, was safe from Manson's insatiable lust for death, blood, and murder. But after the sports car incident, Manson's directions became very specific. He directed Linda to the Los Feliz section of Los Angeles, not far from Griffith Park, having her stop on the street in front of a home in a residential area. Linda recognized the house. In June of 1968, she and her husband had been driving from Seattle to Taos when they stopped off in Los Angeles. A friend had taken them to the house, 3267 Waverly Drive, for a peyote party. One of the men who were living there, she recalled, was named Harold. In another of the many coincidences which abounded in this case, Linda had also been to the Harold True residence, though at a time none of the family members were there. Linda asked, "Charlie, you're not going to do that house, are you?" Manson replied, "No, the one next door." Telling the others to stay in the car, Manson got out. Linda noticed him shove something into his belt, but she couldn't see what it was. She watched him walking up the driveway until it curved, and he disappeared from sight. I presumed, although I couldn't be sure of this, that Manson had a gun. For Rosemary and Lino LaBianca, the horror that would end in their deaths had begun. Linda guessed the time was about 2 a.m. Some 10 minutes later, she said, Manson returned to the car. I asked Linda if he was still wearing the leather thong around his neck. She said she hadn't noticed, though she did notice later that night that he no longer had it. I showed her the leather thong used to bind the wrists of Lino LaBianca, and she said it was the same kind Manson had been wearing. Manson told Tex, Katie, and Leslie to get out of the car and bring their clothing bundles with them. Obviously, they were to be the first team. Linda heard some, though not all, of the conversation. Manson told the trio that there were two people inside the house, that he had tied them up and told them that everything was going to be all right and that they shouldn't be afraid. He also instructed Tex, Katie, and Leslie that they were not to cause fear and panic in the people, as had happened the night before. The LaBiancas had been creepy-crawled, pacified with Charles Manson's unctuous assurances, then set up to be slaughtered. Linda heard only bits and pieces of the rest of the conversation. She did not hear Manson specifically order the three to kill the two persons, nor did she see them carrying any weapons. She believed she heard Manson say, "Don't let them know you were going to kill them." And she definitely heard him instruct them that when they were done, they were to hitchhike back to the ranch. As the trio started toward the house, Manson got back in the car and handed Linda a woman's wallet, telling her to wipe off the prints and remove the change. In opening it, she noticed the driver's license, which had a photo of a woman with dark hair. She recalled the woman's first name was Rosemary, while the last name was either Mexican or Italian. She also remembered seeing a number of credit cards and a wristwatch. When I asked Linda the color of the wallet, she said it was red. Actually, it was brown. She also claimed to have removed all the change, but when the wallet was found, there were still some coins in one of the inner compartments. Both were understandable errors, I felt, particularly overlooking the extra change compartment. Manson again took over the driving. Linda was now on the passenger side, Susan and Clem in back. Manson told Linda that when they reached a predominantly colored area, he wanted her to toss the wallet out onto a sidewalk so a black person would find it, use the credit cards, and be arrested. This would make people think the Panthers had committed the murders, he explained. Manson drove onto the freeway not far from where they had dropped off Tex, Katie, and Leslie. After driving for a long time, he pulled off the freeway and stopped at a nearby service station. Apparently having changed his plans, Manson now told Linda to put the wallet in the women's restroom. Linda did, only she hid it too well, lifting the top of the toilet tank and placing it over the bulb where it would remain undiscovered for 4 months. I asked Linda if she could remember anything distinctive about the station. She remembered there was a restaurant next door and that it seemed to radiate the color orange. There was a Denny's restaurant next to the Standard Station in Sylmar, with a large orange sign. When Linda was in the restroom, Manson went to the restaurant, returning with 4 milkshakes. Probably at the same time the LaBiancas were being murdered, the man who had ordered their deaths was sipping a milkshake. Again Manson had Linda drive. After a long time, perhaps an hour, they reached the beach somewhere south of Venice. Linda recalled seeing some oil storage tanks. All four got out of the car, Sadie and Clem, at Charlie's instructions, dropping behind while he and Linda walked ahead in the sand. Suddenly Manson was again all love. It was as if the events of the last 48 hours had never happened. Linda told Charlie that she was pregnant. Manson took Linda's hand, and as she described it, "It was sort of nice, you know. We were just talking. I gave him some peanuts, and he just sort of made me forget about everything. Made me feel good." Would the jury understand this? I thought so, once they understood Manson's charismatic personality and Linda's love for him. Just as they reached a side street, a police car pulled up, and 2 officers got out. They asked the pair what they were doing. Charlie replied, "We were just going for a walk." Then, as if they should recognize him, he asked, "Don't you know who I am? Or don't you remember my name?" They said, "No," then returned to the patrol car and drove off, without asking either for identification. It was, Linda said, a friendly conversation, lasting only a minute. Finding the 2 officers on duty in the area that night should be fairly easy, I thought, unaware how wrong I could be. Clem and Sadie were already back in the car when they returned. Manson then told Linda to drive to Venice. En route, he asked the 3 if they knew anyone there. None did. Manson then asked Linda, "What about the man you and Sandy met in Venice? Wasn't he a piggy?" Linda replied, "Yes, he's an actor." Manson told her to drive to his apartment. I asked Linda about the actor.
One afternoon in early August, Linda said, she and Sandy had been hitchhiking near the pier when this man picked them up. He told them he was Israeli or Arab, Linda couldn't recall which, and that he had appeared in a movie about Khalil Gibran. The two girls were hungry, and he drove them to his apartment and fixed them lunch. Afterward, Sandy napped, and Linda and the man made love. Before the girls left, he gave them some food and spare clothing. Linda couldn't remember the man's name, only that it was foreign. However, she felt sure she could find the apartment house, as she had located it when Manson asked her to drive there that night. When they pulled up in front, Manson asked Linda if the man would let her in. "I think so," she replied. "What about Sadie and Clem?" Linda said she guessed so. Manson then handed her a pocket knife and demonstrated how he wanted her to slit the actor's throat. Linda said she couldn't do it. "I'm not you, Charlie," Linda told Manson. "I can't kill anybody." Manson asked her to take him to the man's apartment. Linda led Charlie up the stairs, but deliberately pointed to the wrong door. On returning to the car, Manson gave the trio explicit instructions. They were to go to the actor's apartment. Linda was to knock. When the man let her in, Sadie and Clem were to go in also. Once they were inside, Linda was to slit the man's throat, and Clem was to shoot him. When finished, they were to hitchhike back to the ranch. Linda saw Manson hand Clem a gun, but was unable to describe it. Nor did she know if Sadie also had a knife. "If anything goes wrong," Manson told them, "just hang it up. Don't do it." He then slid into the driver's seat and drove off. Like the church and sports car incidents, Susan Atkins had not mentioned the Venice incident to me, nor had she said anything about it when testifying before the grand jury. While I felt that she might have forgotten the two earlier incidents, I suspected the third was omitted intentionally, since it directly involved her as a willing partner in still another attempted murder. It was possible, however, that had I had more time to interview Susan, this too might have come out. The actor's apartment was on the top or fifth floor, but Linda did not tell Clem or Sadie this. Instead, on reaching the fourth floor, she knocked on the first door she saw. Eventually, a man sleepily asked, "Who is it?" She replied, "Linda." When the man opened the door a crack, Linda said, "Oh, excuse me, I have the wrong apartment." The door was only open a second or two, and Linda caught just a glimpse of the man. She had the impression, though she was unsure of this, that he was middle-aged. The three then left the building, but not before Sadie, ever the animal, defecated on the landing. It was obvious that Linda Kasabian had prevented still another Manson-ordered murder. As independent evidence corroborating her story, it was important that we locate not only the actor but the man who answered the door. Perhaps he'd remember being awakened at 4 or 5 a.m. by a pretty young girl. From the apartment house, Clem, Sadie, and Linda walked to the beach, a short distance away. Clem wanted to ditch the gun. He disappeared from sight behind a sand pile near a fence. Linda presumed that he had either buried the gun or tossed it over the fence. Walking back to the Pacific Coast Highway, they hitched a ride to the entrance of Topanga Canyon. There was a hippie crash pad nearby, next door to the Malibu feed bin, and Sadie said she knew a girl who was staying there. Linda recalled there was also an older man there and a big dog. The three stayed about an hour, smoking some weed, then left. They then hitched two rides, the last taking them all the way to the entrance of Santa Susana Pass Road, where Clem and Linda got out. Sadie, Linda learned the next day, remained in the car until it reached the waterfall area. When Linda and Clem arrived at the ranch, Tex and Leslie were already there, asleep in one of the rooms. She didn't see Katie, though she learned the next day that, like Sadie, she had gone on to the camp by the waterfall. Linda went to bed in the saloon. 2 days later, Linda Kasabian fled Spawn Ranch. The manner of her departure, however, would cause the prosecution a great deal of concern.
Rather than taking Linda directly to the La Bianca residence, I had the sheriff's deputy drive to the Los Feliz area to see if Linda could find the house itself. She did, pointing out both the La Bianca and True houses, the place where they had parked, the driveway up which Manson had walked, and so on. I also wanted to find the two houses in Pasadena where Manson had stopped earlier that night, but though we spent hours looking for them, we were at this time unsuccessful. Linda did find the apartment house where the actor had lived, 1101 Oceanfront Walk, and pointed out both his apartment, 501, and the door on which she had knocked, 403. I asked Patchett and Gutierrez to locate and interview both the actor and the man who had been living in 403. Linda also showed us the sand pile near the fence where she believed Clem had disposed of the gun, but though we got out shovels and dug up the area, we were unable to locate the weapon. It was possible that someone had already found it, or that Clem or one of the other family members had reclaimed it later. We never did learn what type of gun it was. Having been out since early in the morning, we stopped at a Chinese restaurant for lunch. That afternoon, we returned to Pasadena and must have driven past 40 churches before Linda found the one where Manson had stopped. I asked LAPD to photograph it and the adjoining parking lot as a trial exhibit. Linda also identified the Standard station in Sylmar where she'd left the wallet, as well as Denny's restaurant next door. Despite all our security precautions, we were spotted. The next day, the Herald Examiner reported, in addition to winning immunity, Mrs. Kasabian was given a bonus in the form of a Chinese dinner at Madame Wu's Garden Restaurant in Santa Monica. Restaurant employees confirmed Mrs. Kasabian, defense attorney Fleischman, and prosecutor Bugliosi ate there Sunday. The paper neglected to mention that our party included a half dozen LAPD officers and two LASO deputies. We took Linda out twice more, trying to find the two houses in Pasadena. On both occasions, we were accompanied by South Pasadena PD officers who directed us to neighborhoods similar to those Linda had described. We finally found the large house atop the hill. Though I had it and the adjoining houses photographed, they were close together, as Manson had said, I decided against talking to the owners, sure they would sleep better not knowing how close to death they had come. We were never able to locate the first house, which both Susan and Linda had described, where Manson looked in the window and saw the photographs of the children. We did grant Linda one special privilege, which might have been called a bonus. On the three occasions we took her out of Sybil Brand, we let her call her mother in New Hampshire and talk to her two children. Her attorney paid for the calls. Though Angel was only a month old and much too young to understand, just speaking to them obviously meant a great deal to Linda. Yet she never asked to do this. She never asked for anything. She told me not once but several times that although she was pleased to be getting immunity because it meant that eventually she could be with her children, it didn't matter that much if she didn't get it. There was a sort of sad fatalism about her. She said she knew she had to tell the truth about what had happened, and that she had known she would be the one to tell the story ever since the murders occurred. Unlike the other defendants, she seemed burdened with guilt, though, again unlike them, she hadn't physically harmed anyone. She was a strange girl, marked by her time with Manson, yet not molded by him in the same way the others were. Because she was compliant, easily led, Manson apparently had had little trouble controlling her, up to a point. But she had refused to cross that point. "I'm not you, Charlie. I can't kill anybody." Once I asked her what she thought about Manson now. She was still in love with him, Linda said. "Some things he said were the truth," she observed thoughtfully. "Only now I realize he could take a truth and make a lie of it." Shortly after the story broke that Linda Kasabian would testify for the prosecution, Al Wyman, the reporter with the Channel 7 crew which had found the clothing, showed up in my office. If Kasabian was cooperating with us, Then she must have indicated where she threw the knives, Wyman surmised. He begged me to pinpoint the area. His station, he promised, would supply a search crew, metal detectors, everything. Look, Al, I told him, you guys have already found the clothing. How is it going to look at the trial if you find the knives, too? Tell you what, I'm trying to get someone out. If they won't go, then I'll tell you. After Wyman left, I called McGann. 2 weeks had passed since I'd asked him to look for the knives. He still hadn't done it. My patience at an end, I called Lieutenant Helder and told him about Wyman's offer. Think how LAPD is going to look if it comes out during the trial that a 10-year-old boy found the gun and Channel 7 found both the clothing and the knives. Bob had a crew out the next day. No luck. But at least during the trial we'd be prepared to prove that they had looked. Otherwise, the defense could contend that LAPD was so skeptical of Linda Kasabian's story that they hadn't even bothered to mount a search. That they'd failed to find the knives was a disappointment, but not too much of a surprise. Over 7 months had passed since the night Linda tossed the knives out of the car. According to her testimony, one had bounced back into the road while the other had landed in the bushes nearby. The street, though in the country, was much traveled. It was quite possible they had been picked up by a motorist or passing cyclist. I had no idea how often the police had interviewed Winifred Chapman, the Polanski's maid. I'd talked to her a number of times myself before I realized there was one question so obvious we'd all overlooked it. Mrs. Chapman had stated that she washed the front door of the Tate residence just after noon on Friday, August 8th. This meant Charles Watson had to have left his print there sometime after this. However, there was a second print found at the Tate residence, Patricia Krenwinkle's, located inside the door that led from Sharon Tate's bedroom to the pool. I asked Mrs. Chapman, did you ever wash that door? Yes. How often? A couple of times a week. She had to, she explained, because the guests usually used that door to get to the pool. The big question. Did you wash it the week of the murders, and if so, when? Answer. Tuesday was the last time. I washed it down inside and out with vinegar and water. Under discovery, I was only required to make a note of the conversation and put it in our tubs. However, in fairness to both Fitzgerald and his client, I called Paul and told him, if you're planning on having Krenwinkle testify that she went swimming at the Tate residence a couple of weeks before the murders and left her print at that time, better forget it. Mrs. Chapman is going to testify she washed that door on Tuesday, August 5th. Paul was grateful for the information. Had he based his defense on this premise, Mrs. Chapman's testimony could have been devastating. There was, in such conversations, something assumed, though unstated. Whatever his public posture, I was sure that Fitzgerald knew that his client was guilty, and he knew that I knew it. Though only on rare occasions does a defense attorney slip up and admit this in court, when it comes to in-chambers discussions and private conversations, it's often something else. There were two items of evidence in our files which I did not point out to the defense. I was sure they had already seen them. Both were among the items photocopied for them, but I was hoping they wouldn't realize their importance. One was a traffic ticket, the other an arrest report. Separately, each seemed unimportant. Together, they made a bomb that would demolish Manson's alibi defense. On first learning from Foles that Manson might claim that he was not in the Los Angeles area at the time of the murders, I had asked LaBianca detectives Patchett and Gutierrez to see if they could obtain evidence proving his actual whereabouts on the subject dates. They did an excellent job. Together with information obtained from credit card transactions and interviews, they were able to piece together a timetable of Manson's activities during the week preceding the start of Helter Skelter. On about August 1, 1969, Manson told several family members that he was going to Big Sur to seek out new recruits. He apparently left on the morning of Sunday, August 3rd, as sometime between 7 and 8, he purchased gas at a station in Canoga Park using a stolen credit card. From Canoga Park, he headed north toward Big Sur. At about 4 the next morning,